Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we talk about on this podcast. I share ideas and strategies and blueprints. I tell stories. I share what works, but also some of my big epic fails that I've made along the way. And all because I truly believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And one of the things I love to do is talk to the real experts out there, the people who have been doing the deeper work and thinking in all of these different domains, especially on ideas like project-based learning and design thinking. And today I have the chance to share with you an interview with one of the foremost experts in design thinking. Her name is Susie Wise. She's one of the deepest thinkers I know. I've been following her work for a long time. I love that it is eminently practical, but also she just has a bold imagination on how we can rethink education. A little bit about her. Dr. Susie Wise is a design leader with experience in the education, tech, and social sectors. She coaches leaders in equity design and innovation practices. She teaches at the D School at Stanford and coaches with the Mira Fellowship. Previously, she founded and directed the K-12 Lab and the D School and co-created Liberatory Design. And I'm telling you, she has this amazing new book called Design for Belonging. I think it just came out, and it is a phenomenal read. I sat down and I read it in one day, so it's one of those books that you can read quickly. And then I reread it more deeply because there are so many practical ideas. She shares big, bold ideas, and then these practices and protocols that you can actually use. And I've got to say, the book itself is it's just a beautiful book visually. And I love, obviously, if you've seen my website and stuff, I love sketches and drawings, and I love art and that side of design. And so the book is just a gorgeous book to look at. And then, obviously, it's practical. It's filled with big, bold ideas on this intersection of equity and design. And so it was such an honor to be able to interview her. And without further ado, here is the interview. All right, we have with us here Susie Wise, and I'm so excited to talk to you about designing, design thinking, and really the book that is going to be coming out soon, Design for Belonging. I told you this before we got started. I absolutely loved this book. I love that it is a fast read, it's a practical read, but it's also a big idea book. And the way that you blended together so many different voices, such a diverse representation of voices and ideas, but also the bigger unifying idea of belonging and what that means. This is really one of my favorite books, education books I've read in the last year. So absolutely loved it. I read it. It's a fast read. I read it over the course of a 6-hour airplane ride. But also it's the kind of book I know I'm going to reread and go back to, especially again, the practical exercises that you shared and those things. So I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to talk about it. And thank you for digging into the book. As you say, it's a book that is designed actually to be picked up and used so that you can read it quickly, and also that you can go back and be like, oh, I'm walking into a meeting. Maybe I want to try this check-in question, or maybe I want to get people to try an emotional journey map. Yeah. It's designed to be practical.
I love it. And I really think, just given how busy K-12 educators are, and even higher education educators are, right? I mean, in every area, the practicality of it, the clarity of it, the simplicity in a beautiful way, the visual elements, I think it's going to be a phenomenal read. So highly recommend this book ahead of time before we even get into that.
Thank you so much.
Now, I'd love to start with a little bit of your story. So how did you first get into design thinking and even design work in general?
Sure. So I am somebody who thought I was going to be in politics, ended up falling into the early days of technology and education, really enjoying it. That took me to Stanford before there was a thing called the D School. Mm-hmm. But I discovered human-centered design there and recognized that in some ways, design thinking and design were how I had been intuitively working on the software that I'd been designing in the world beforehand. I'd been designing games and experiences for young people and also for museum visitors. And I always did that work by asking the real people the real questions about what they were wondering about, what they were confused about, and then also sharing early designs for interfaces and games with folks. Mm-hmm. And I found that I really love to be in those conversations, understanding how tools were working for people. So that's what led me to Stanford to pursue work in learning sciences and technology design. And then I was there as the D School got started and had these kind of a series of incredible moments where I was like, oh, there's a name for the way I love to work. It's called design thinking. It's called human-centered design. Ultimately, it's called designing for people and what they need. Mm-hmm. And so I loved that I discovered that there were more people using those kinds of tools that I was kind of intuitively drawn to.
You know, I think it's interesting that you bring that up because I first learned about design thinking. And at the time when I would mention it, there was a perception when I would talk to my friends from university and everything, there was always this perception of it's an engineering thing, right? There was often this like confusion between that and the engineering process. And what I found so interesting is I came at design thinking, not through the lens of a teacher, but I worked for a nonprofit and we were using it for systems and program development, right?
Absolutely.
And it was all about this, the role of empathy, this, the human-centered design, the notion of designing with, not for, the intersection of equity and design. And that's kind of when I first discovered your work a long time ago. And the whole notion of, I love the fact that from the beginning, you've brought in the equity perspective and the human perspective that I think can easily be lost in someone who just looks at a framework, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we've needed to do and have done in recent years some more work to get really explicit about that. When we started the K-12 lab at the D School, we had an underlying notion that we were trying to work towards, use design to work towards equity in American schools. Mm-hmm. And we knew that. But it wasn't always crisp and clear to other folks that were taking up the tools. So if you already had an equity agenda in your work or you were trying to redesign in order to correct for inequities in the systems you were working with, you could use the tools. But we decided to go further and push and really call out what we now call sometimes liberatory design, mm-hmm. that we're trying to bring together an equity lens, a design lens, and a complexity lens, mm-hmm. to take the work further in systems design. Mm-hmm. And I'll say this work and mentioning the book, Design for Belonging, comes out of that digging into liberatory design and digging in with educators that were working on their equity challenges, but sometimes getting bogged down in a kind of technical approach to what designing in their equity challenges could look like. And I found that offering the framing of belonging, and originally, as I share in the book, it comes from John Powell and his notion of othering and belonging. Mm-hmm. Belonging just kind of cracks things open for people. Mm-hmm. And then if you pair it with the notion that design is about being active in the world and trying things out and seeing what happens, that you can do that towards belonging, mm-hmm. becomes a really powerful combination.
And so you mentioned the book. I want to kind of get into this a little bit. I love the idea that you brought up connecting to Powell's work of othering and belonging. And I'm wondering if you would explain a little bit for people who aren't familiar with that. What is that distinction and why does it matter?
Yeah. So belonging is that sense. It's a feeling, right? The feeling of belonging that I'm not only included, but who I am is sought out and honored, that I can show up as my whole self. Mm-hmm. That's what it feels like to belong. Mm-hmm. And then othering is, of course, its really detrimental opposite, which is being made to feel that you and potentially your community are not welcome, are unwanted. You may be projected upon with stereotypes. Mm-hmm. It can go so far as to be really threatening. Mm-hmm. Othering can. It can also be very subtle. And yet we as humans are so attuned to whether we are being called in to belong or whether we are being pushed aside that we notice it with really small cues. Mm-hmm. So part of why it becomes really important to design for belonging is to ensure that we're not othering, that we're not falling into that pushing people away, making folks feel threatened.
So outside of just design thinking and designing in general, what are some moments you think that othering is occurring in K-12 classrooms? Like, what are some things that teachers might want to look out for?
Yeah, so in the K-12 classroom, I think it's useful to think about a really wide range of moments. One of the things I do in the book is talk about moments because it helps to break down. Right? Culture is kind of a big word, right? And it's an accumulation, but it's an accumulation of small moments. So for educators, you're thinking about how am I inviting and welcoming students into a classroom? Mm-hmm. But you're also thinking about how am I helping students to feel like they can persevere when they're stuck? Mm-hmm. Because we know, right? For learning, you have to have productive struggle. Mm-hmm. But if you're not set up to feel like struggle is apparent and part of the work that we do here in this classroom, you can take that as a cue that maybe you don't belong. Mm-hmm. And so there's a risk there in the very important struggle of learning that if you haven't set up enough to be supportive of students and their growth, that you can push them to feeling like perhaps they don't belong. Perhaps I'm not really a learner. Perhaps I can't succeed here. Yeah. So those moments of perseverance and growth, productive struggle really matter for belonging. Belonging really matters for them. And then I think there's also some moments to think about a little bit further downstream, which is what do you do if you're a student and things don't feel like they're working for you? How do you give feedback? How do you articulate enough to have your needs met potentially in some new and different ways? And you might need allies or other partners to help you in those conversations. None of this work should be left kind of exclusively to teacher and student if supports are needed to build. Because ultimately, the sense of belonging that we're trying to create in classrooms is that whatever your identity is, whatever your learning needs are, wherever you're coming from in terms of your family or culture, that we're inviting you to show up and be an active learner in this community.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. When I read that section, I actually remember kind of stopping and just jotting down some memories of moments that were growth moments for me on othering that I didn't think about. You know, one was, you know, being exposed to the idea of neurodiversity and that not making the distinction between special ed and regular, which was sort of what we were taught in college. And the shift from pulling small groups during a project, because, you know, I would do project-based learning, pull small groups to optional workshops that were universally accessible to anybody and just calling it additional workshops and the changing of the language there. Or, I think of a growth moment where students were signing up for a coding project. You know, they were learning how to code, and the first question it asks is gender. You know, and at first it's just male, female, and I have a transgender student, and the struggle of that, and sending that particular group an email, and so then they switched it to male, female, other, and then the othering of gender, right, and the conversation of where I said, I'm learning, like I'm learning this, help us learn. This particular organization was really good about reaching out to activists, community members, and changing the language, even of just the sign-up piece, right? Or, you know, the differentiation of space in terms of loud and quiet, in terms of flexibility. And I love that you brought in the role of the physical space in your book as well, because that I feel like that makes a huge difference, again, in that sense of belonging versus othering that can happen.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so there you're talking about those moments of invitation or being invited to participate, and also starting to dig into then, so how do we shape a particular moment? There are so many, that whole section on shaping belonging is really about flexing different levers of design. So space. We send so many cues with the space. Whose stories might be represented in the space? What does it feel like, to your point about neurodiversity? Are there quiet places for folks that get overwhelmed by too much stimulation? Are there louder places for folks that need to get kind of jazzed up in order to feel like they're creative or that they can dig into a new territory? So space is one of these really powerful levers of design. Role. Super interesting, particularly I think for teachers who are used to having such a central role. But what are the other kinds of roles that you create in the classroom? You can think back to like kindergarten classrooms, and there are all those different jobs, right, that people get to have, which is, I think, a way that we're introducing that you can design different roles. And so you can actually create different roles. So who's the welcomer? Who's the, right, who's the person that's actually going to raise the difficult feedback, right? So more in a high school classroom, you could have more sophisticated rules that are really looking after the culture of the classroom and ensuring that it's moving towards belonging and away from othering. I also like to raise up the notion of events and rituals. Ritual, again, is this very human thing that we build and have seemingly for millennia. And we do a lot of ritual building in classrooms, but we don't want them to get reified if they're not working. We don't want to be stuck in them. And so part of, I think, what I'm trying to do in this book and a lot of my work is just to remind us that everything is designed, and it, therefore it can be redesigned. If it's not working, if people are not feeling belonging, if people are feeling alienated, uncomfortable, et cetera, those are cues, which is why the feeling part really matters. You have to take up those cues. Not everybody's going to say, excuse me, I don't feel like I belong here. That's going to be a very rare occurrence. And yet you're going to be able to notice discomfort if you're tuning into the feelings, or if you're just getting explicit and asking. You mentioned that there are a bunch of tools in the book. One of them is just a simple emotional journey map.
I love that. I was just about to say, you know, one of the things that I was struck by in that early section where you were first getting into it is this feels so big. And then I love the fact that you bring it into something very practical. So I love the fact that you're talking about this. So I'm sorry I interrupted you, but
no, sure. It's great.
I would love for you to walk us through how the emotional journey map works.
Yeah. So the idea is simply that you have, you can turn a piece of paper horizontally, have a y-axis axis that is positive and negative emotion, and your x-axis is time. And you can situate it however you want. Perhaps you're a classroom teacher and you're asking about this year. So what, and asking students and yourself to map the year with marking the ups and downs of when and where did you feel belonging. And the important thing here is not just the shape of that line from the highs and lows of belonging, the neutrals, etc. it's also to look at the very specific stories that come up mm-hmm. and to be able to use that tool actually to have a conversation. Oh, wow. I see that in September you felt a really strong sense of belonging. But now that we're here in April, there are a number of different moments you've identified where you felt really negative on your belonging. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that? Can we dig into that? And then you can dig into the, right, you've identified the feeling, you can dig into the specifics, what was happening, with whom, where, what was the context? And that's the part then that opens you to design, because you can say, wow, that particular event made the girls feel like this was something that was only for boys. You know, this is a hypothetical, but yeah. a student might be telling you the story of like, wow, I went to this particular class. It was mostly boys. I didn't feel like anybody was calling on me. I didn't feel like I was included. I felt like I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. Gender is just one dimension that you might experience othering or belonging around. Mm-hmm. The value of the tool is to get to those conversations of what were those highs and lows. Yeah. And in terms of the highs, those are also the things to build on. Wow, we're doing a really good job at a particular kind of assembly that brings folks together in larger group. That's really interesting. We could use that then as some inspiration for what can we do in other contexts that feels a little bit more like that. Oh, it's because we had an outside speaker that was really skilled at ensuring that everybody's ideas were included. Great, let's do more of those kinds of things because we know that the energy of an outside speaker is gonna help shift things. Great. So mining both the highs and the lows is super fruitful for design.
One of the things I loved about that particular strategy is the way you can sort of, it's very individual and it's subjective and it's based on feelings, but you can also find those patterns that emerge, right? And I'm reminded of, you know, I did an activity the first time that I shifted toward having more of a maker space. And I did an activity with the students where I asked them to color code a map of the classroom. And all they had to do was color it and determine what spaces they felt like were theirs individually, what spaces they felt like were theirs in terms of own ownership by the students as a whole, the class, which parts they felt like belonged to the teacher. And it was eye-opening to me to see not only individual students who felt certain things, but certain groups. And this weird gender thing that came up, which was that the board, which was available, the whiteboards were available for groups to write on, the girls weren't feeling like the boards belonged to them, right? It was a very like, oh, eye-opening moment. And it was only through sort of an overlay process of looking at these things and seeing visually the trends. Yeah. So one of the things I love about this is that it is, at one hand, very qualitative, right? But then there's this like quantitative element of looking at trends that can emerge from something like this as well.
Yeah, I love that. And that's a brilliant example. And there's another exercise in the book about making a map of places you feel you belong. So you yeah. can imagine
yes.
doing it like you did in the context of a classroom, bigger mm-hmm. picture across a campus, potentially. Where do folks feel that they belong? And the experience of doing it is that very individual. So you also feel it has a kind of potentially good feeling of like, well, I'm understanding myself and my space, and it feels kind of good to share it. And then you can have that deeper conversation when you look across multiple maps mm-hmm. or multiple journey lines or multiple metaphors. Another activity is just using a metaphor to say,
yes,
right? Belonging for me at this school feels like, I guess that's a simile technically with yeah. the like in there, but right, is, and working those metaphors can be really mm-hmm. interesting.
Yeah. And you provide, one of the things I loved about that is, and this is a kind of a subtle thing that, but I'm sure it was done with intentionality, is that you have that strategy of the metaphors, but I love the fact that it's written out as a sentence frame, because I think about my experience in teaching ELL students, which itself feels a little bit othering, right? Like, let's be honest,
yeah.
multilingual students would be a better
yes.
term.
Yes.
Who were learning English. If I had said create a metaphor, it would have been a real struggle. But I looked at this and immediately thought, how beautifully accessible that particular, I'm trying to find it right here in the book, sorry. But I love the fact that it's written out as sentence frames that they can access.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're doing such a beautiful job too. I can tell you're such an attentive educator too, of calling out how language is a tool of design. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the one we like over rely on. So design has a role to remind us to use space and role and ritual and other things. But language can be either very embracing or quite othering in lots of ways. And I think thankfully we notice and know that language changes over time. Yeah. We have the ability now to ask people, you know, what pronouns would you like to use? That's an inclusive gesture, using language to help people know that they belong.
And on the topic of language, I love the fact that you, there was a section that brought up this idea of code switching, and there was a section written by Boots Riley, and this whole idea of code switching within design. And that was honestly kind of an aha moment for me, where I'd known about the topic of code switching. I'd seen it, but I hadn't thought much about how that fits into the notion of belonging and the ideas of design. So I'm curious if you'd talk a little bit about, you know, what that means in terms of code switching and what that would actually mean and look like for our students.
Yeah. So code switching, you know, comes out of linguistics. Mm-hmm. It's the notion of being able to move, you know, initially from language to language, language as a code. Mm-hmm. We also notice, and folks have done, not me, but linguistics researchers have done a fair amount of research on what that looks like for folks in classrooms if you're coming from the non-dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of African-American youth that are speaking in non-standard English, sometimes when they go to school, there's been a history of discrimination there. So there's been work done to lift up code switching and to really understand it cognitively. It's being multilingual, even if it's right, it's vernaculars within the English language. And that's incredibly powerful and points to incredible skills of awareness and understanding. It's also, because it is it's a cognitive load, it can also be quite exhausting to do that. And that's true for bilingual students, as well as kind of in this code switching within English between like a more standard English and a less standard English. I think those distinctions may be, I think the language that we use to even talk about that is going to continue to evolve. Mm-hmm. I wanted to raise it in part, and I raised it in the book in relationship to Boots Riley, because I really loved the film, Sorry to Bother You. Mm-hmm. One version of this book, I was going to use a lot of different films, and it didn't quite come together. Mm-hmm. But I had to include that film because it has such an explicit kind of examination of how code switching works that I wanted to include it. And just to raise up then the notion of paying attention for folks, for dominant culture folks, to pay attention to when and where code switching is happening, and also for folks in non-dominant cultures to know that is a load, and that for belonging, we can seek to, if we're building environments, we can seek to reduce that load if it is becoming, you know, cumbersome or burdensome in different contexts. Again, code switching is a powerful thing. You don't necessarily want to be called on to do it all the time. Yeah. And you certainly don't want to be necessarily the person kind of called on to be translating for everyone, because that's an additional role. Mm-hmm. Unless that's being supported and is part of kind of community building that folks have signed up for and kind of joined in on explicitly and willingly.
You know, one of the things I'm struck by is, you know, as you talk about that, is how I don't know how often students even hear about the notion themselves of code switching, and that that's what's going on, and that the cognitive load is occurring, and that that to be able to code switch is a skill and an asset, not a deficit, right? I mean, absolutely. There's so much of that. And it just feels like if students are working on a meaningful project and connecting to the community and interviewing experts and just, you know, doing a lot of the work that is done during design thinking, it seems like a great way, a great moment to teach them that this is what code switching is. This is what's happening right now. Even to just put a label to it and a conversation about it.
Yeah. And I think there's also the potential that from that place, you say, gosh, talk however you want right now, right? Group, you know, purple group, yeah. Talk however you want. Green group, you speak however you want. We're going to do our presentations in a particular format, perhaps drawing on particular aspects of our standard classroom English, because that's something that we're practicing with for formal presentations, or not. We could actually decide that that's not what the requirement of the present. Not every presentation has to be that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some interesting flexibility there. It depends what your learning goals are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm curious, one of the themes that kind of came up throughout it as well, just from a general thing that I saw, was the whole idea of layers of belonging and really intersectionality. And so I was wondering if you'd talk just a little bit about where you see intersectionality occurring within the idea of design, designing for belonging.
Yeah, thank you for that question. One of the things I'm a smidge disappointed in myself around the book is that I kept trying to get to a visual mm-hmm. about intersectionality to really call it out. And I didn't get there. I think the book, the layers in the book end up pointing towards it, but I thought a visual would be really interesting and I didn't quite get there. So that piece of, we have multiple identities. We feel belonging in different groups. Mm-hmm. This is normal, natural. We're not trying to. This is sometimes when I've spoken with folks about belonging, there can be a question of, well, is it a zero-sum game? It's not a zero-sum game. We have multiple aspects of our identities. We're going to feel belonging in different ways. It's also going to shift in real time, over mm-hmm. our lifetime, in different contexts, etc. So that's normal and natural, and I think cause for celebration and interest and lots of different ways to work with that. Mm-hmm. It is one of that, it's maybe part of why I raised code switching too, is just to dig into the notion that sometimes, like, you can be in context where parts of your identity feel like they're, you know, getting tugged at or in mm-hmm. conflict in some way. And mm-hmm. so designing for our intersectional selves is part of, right? And for learning context to design for us to be able to show up as our whole selves, mm-hmm. I think is really powerful.
Yeah, definitely. You know, one of the things that I was struck by also was sort of the intentionality of language and almost a different language for a lot of what we say in the classroom. Like, I loved the fact that you mentioned rituals rather than saying procedures, right? Which is tend to, or I just lost it. The idea of routines and what was the? I had it in here. Schedules and rhythms, right? Rather than, you know, it's just a different sort of language, even in terms of the way we talk about it. And I was struck by how the language itself seemed to be very human-centered and resembled more the way you hear, I guess, anthropologists talk about people groups and less the way that you hear business talk about people, right? Which classrooms tend to adopt a lot of business language.
Okay. Okay, interesting.
And I'm curious, just where do you see the language the teachers use, even the way that we talk about the community of a classroom itself, shaping the interactions in a classroom?
Well, let me come around. Can I say a little bit about kind of how you led into that too, uh-huh. and yeah, then get yeah. to the classroom language uh-huh. piece? I think for me, some of that, the play with language or using language from across a number of different contexts in which mm-hmm. I've worked,
yeah,
felt germane to me in this, because it's part of how I think about what design is. Mm-hmm. So design to me is, you know, is simply creative problem solving on one level, like the most basic definition for me. Uh-huh. And I think that part of the power of design and things that I've learned from the field of design mm-hmm. is to draw inspiration from lots of different places. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel sad that teachers and classrooms and schools get kind of unintegrated from the rest of the working world, mm. right? You're in the classroom, you need to be in the classroom. That's great and right. And teachers do such a good job holding space for students to be there and be learning. And it's hard to explore really widely or attend a wide variety of professional learning experiences, et cetera. And so part of the work that I love doing with educators around design is just trying out some different frames, some different language, mm-hmm. because it just helps you think in a slightly different direction. So I'm mm-hmm. excited that this book doesn't have exactly precise educator language. Uh-huh. And that's partially because the honest truth is I've never been a classroom teacher, yeah. right, in a K-12 classroom in a school district in the United States of America. I wasn't brave enough to do that. Early on, right, I kept trying to apply to credential programs, and at the last minute, I would somehow pivot and work with a nonprofit that went into school. So I've mm-hmm. always so deeply appreciated getting to work with classroom teachers, but I've never been one. And so part of what I'm always trying to do is offer some slightly different tools, some slightly different language, some slightly different approaches in support of educators' brilliant creativity. Because mm-hmm. that's what I see when I work with educators, is so creative, so dedicated, and that they have a lot of fun opening up and looking at things from a slightly different angle. So that's part of what I think I'm doing around the language.
So to kind of bring it all home a little bit, if you've got a teacher who is looking at this and they say, I think this is important. I think this is important work. But I also realize there's a lot to do and it can feel a little bit overwhelming. What would you say would be a really good starting place for a teacher who's saying, I want to begin the process of designing for belonging. I really want to think about this. What would be a good, I guess, starting place?
Yeah. So the starting place for me, and I think particularly for educators are so dedicated and they take everything they learn and get exposed to and immediately want to share it with their students. Uh-huh. So my suggestion for starting here would be to pause for a moment and let yourself feel into your own context mm-hmm. and do that journey map of for your last week. Make it simple. For your last week, when and where did you feel belonging? And when and where did you not? And to use that to dig in to say, all right, what kind of a moment was it when I felt it? And what kind of a moment was it when I didn't? And is there anything I could think of, whether or not I have control over how those moments were situated, but is there anything I could think of with my own creativity that might shift that negative belonging moment to be more positive, or that might, where I can learn from that positive belonging moment? I encourage educators to take a beat and try these tools for yourself.
I love it.
And right, in order to just to feel into what belonging is, yeah. and then think about when and where you can move on to then thinking about when and where and for whom belonging is happening in your classroom. That's a really important next step. But yeah. take the beat and think about yourself for a moment, because you give so much to your classroom and your community, you can give yourself a few minutes of thinking about your own belonging experiences.
I love that. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for being willing to answer some questions and engage in this conversation. And again, absolutely love this book. And thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed chatting with you about it. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. So there you have it. Again, that is Dr. Susie Wise, a true expert on design thinking. And please go check out her new book, Design for Belonging. It's one of my favorite education books that I've read in the last couple of years. It is really that good. And also, if you're interested in finding more about her, her website is designforbelonging.com. There are all kinds of great ideas and resources and articles there that you can check out. So again, I would highly recommend that. And I'll tell you what, if you would do me a favor, if you enjoy this podcast, if you find it useful to you at all, would you do me a favor and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.